Welcome to the History of the Americans podcast, episode 150. If episodes were years, this one would be the sesquicentennial. I'm your host, Jack Henneman, and I'm recording this episode on May 1st, 2024, in New Orleans. We are telling the history of the lands now encompassed by the United States from the beginning without intentional presentism. Two carryover announcements before we get going. I'm going to be in downtown Houston for the afternoon and early evening of Friday, May 17th, and would be delighted to meet up with listeners. Shoot me an email at thehistoryoftheamericans@gmail.com or through the contact page on the website, thehistoryoftheamericans.com, or by direct message on X, Twitter, and let me know if you think you would do if we set it up. Also, don't forget to check out the timeline tab on the homepage of the website. I've now put in everything from the first 30 or so episodes through the rise of the merchant adventurers in England. It's kind of been fun to go back through and read the old scripts. There was a lot there even I had forgotten. This episode will be more satisfying if you know something of the English Civil Wars, or if you have listened to our overview, Oliver's Army, What You Need to Know About the English Civil Wars, which went up on April 2nd, 2024. It also wouldn't hurt to have listened to the two recent episodes on New Haven Colony. Careful study of the map of New Haven, Connecticut, not that most people ever have reason to do that, will discover a long street called Wally Avenue and a shorter one called Gough Street. They converge with Dixwell Avenue near Yale's campus, just across from a residential college named after Yale's second president, Ezra Stiles. This intersection memorializes a moment from early America that's fascinated historians and local history buffs for generations. The story of three of the 59 judges who signed the death warrant of the English King Charles I in January 1649. After the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, the judges were declared regicides and exempted from the general amnesty Charles II offered to most people who had opposed his father. Some of the regicides were caught immediately and most gruesomely executed. Others fled to Europe. Three of them went on the lam in New England. Their names were Edward Wally, William Gough, and John Dixwell. To complete the significance of that intersection in New Haven, Ezra Stiles wrote the first book about them around the time of the American Revolution. We know a lot about Wally and Gough, who were fugitives together, and not very much about Dixwell, to such a degree that most of the books that have been written since Stiles relegate Dixwell to a footnote or a couple of paragraphs. We shall do the same, returning to Dixwell mostly to explain why we know so little about him. Edward Wally and William Gough, who'd married Wally's daughter, rose to prominence in the years of the Civil Wars in the Commonwealth. They were accomplished officers in the New Model Army, active also in civil affairs, and devoted followers of Wally's cousin, one Oliver Cromwell. Wally and Gough were both at attendance at Cromwell's deathbed in 1658, and Gough was one of the chief mourners at his funeral. A report to the Lord Chancellor after the restoration of the monarchy describes Edward Wally as, quote, a great stickler against the king, and Gough another. After the restoration of Charles II in May 1660, the new royalist parliament passed an act of free and general pardon, indemnity, and oblivion, known today as the Indemnity and Oblivion Act of 1660. The act gave effect to a promise that Charles had made while still in exile, to grant pardons to the vast majority of those who had opposed him and his father, and that the interregnum, as the period of the Commonwealth was called, was to be legally forgotten. It also provided for the prosecution and punishment of specified individuals determined by Parliament to have been so heinous that they must now be hunted down and cast into oblivion. Among those, as we have seen, were Sir Henry Vane and Hugh Peter. The biggest group of such people, however, were those who had ordered the execution of Charles I. Figuring out who those people were was more difficult than it might seem. The original trial of Charles I had called for 135 named commissioners, or judges, but without their consent. Many of those called did not appear for the trial. In the end, 67 commissioners stood to declare that Charles had traitorously and maliciously levied war against the present Parliament and the people therein represented. There was, however, also a document, a warrant for the execution of Charles I, which had been signed by 59 of the commissioners. The third signatory was Oliver Cromwell. The fourth was Edward Whalley. So one can imagine them standing together when signing. And the 14th was William Gough. Of the 59 judges who had signed the warrant in 1649, more than 20 had already died by 1660, leaving 30 and odd to be hunted down and punished. Some made no attempt to flee, and were imprisoned for life or executed horrifically, the sentence pronounced by the Lord Chief Justice being too harsh for any little kids who you might have listening along. Quote, waiting while you pause the podcast if you need to. The judgment of this court is that you be led back to the place whence you came, and from thence to be drawn upon a hurdle to the place of execution, and there you shall be hanged by the neck, and being alive shall be cut down, and your privy members to be cut off, your entrails to be taken out of your body, and you living, the same to be burnt before your eyes, and your head to be cut off, your body to be divided into four quarters, and your head and quarters to be disposed of at the pleasure of the King's Majesty. And the Lord have mercy upon your soul. Back to me. Suffice it to say that many of the regicides skipped town. Indeed, seeing the writing on the wall, 21 left the country, some even before Charles had returned. Of those, most went to the Netherlands or Switzerland, fewer to Germany and France, and some of those were hunted down and murdered or arrested and brought back for trial in England. Three went to New England and were hunted, but never found, by agents of the Crown. Whalley and Gough knew that their prominence during the Civil Wars and as stalwart allies of Cromwell meant that there would be no clemency for them. Even if they had not foreseen the full extent of the barbarism in the execution of the regicides, they would have plenty of reason to leave. In early May 1660, even before Charles had returned from exile, they assumed the aliases William Stevenson and Edward Richardson and made haste for Gravesend on the south bank of the Thames. Long-standing and attentive listeners will remember that Rebecca Rolfe, known more widely as Pocahontas, had died there just over 43 years before. Those aliases were an early sign that Whalley and Gough were not being careful enough. Insofar as William Gough's father was Stephen, so Stevenson, and Edward Whalley's father was Richard. This was the 17th century equivalent of making your password, password, perhaps with an ampersand in place of the A. They would make more such mistakes before they truly understood the seriousness of their plight. Waiting for them in the roadstead at Gravesend was a small ship, the 75-foot Prudent Mary, all ready to sail to Boston with around 100 people. On May 14th, still 11 days before Charles II would land at Dover, and a mere 4 days before the restored House of Lords decreed that members of the regicide court were to be arrested, the Prudent Mary set sail. She arrived at the mouth of the Charles River between Boston and Charlestown on July 27, 1660. Now let's go to Matthew Jenkinson, whose book, Charles I, Killers in America, The Lives and Afterlives of Edward Whalley and William Gough, is the main source for this episode. Quote, though they had traveled as Richardson and Stevenson, the regicides did not hide their true identity from the eminent Bostonians who greeted them. On the contrary, they presented themselves openly and were received warmly. One of the first individuals to greet them was Governor John Endicott, Massachusetts Bay's chief magistrate, who governed and administered the colony alongside the deputies and assistants of its general court. Back to me. Wally and Gough could be confident that most people in Massachusetts Bay would support them against the restored king. Sadly for them, most is a far cry from all. Word of their arrival spread through New England quickly. By letter dated August 11th, only 15 days after Wally and Gough arrived at the Charles River, John Davenport in New Haven wrote to the governor of Connecticut, John Winthrop Jr., saying that he knew who Wally and Gough were and would like to meet them. In other words, anybody who was anybody in New England at the time probably had heard of them within a few weeks. On August 29th, Parliament passed the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion, and on September 22nd, Charles II put a bounty of 100 pounds sterling on the heads of each of Wally and Gough. On October 11th, the wheels of justice were spinning furiously now. The trials of the captured or surrendered regicides began. On October 16th, the execution started, including Hugh Peter, who had once been the minister at Salem, Massachusetts. New England would not hear of any of this, however, until November 30th, 1660. How the authorities in Massachusetts Bay would respond to the news that Wally and Gough were now officially wanted with a price on their heads by the King of England was influenced as much by the colony's practical concerns as the anti-royalism of its constituents. The politics of the moment were complex, and the posture of the leaders of the Bay toward Wally and Gough were wrapped up in them. Massachusetts and the other colonies had, for most of their 30 or so years, been all but ignored by English authorities, royal and republican alike. Their population was low, they produced very little of economic significance, and Charles I and Oliver Cromwell had, in turn, many higher priorities than worrying about New England. There simply wasn't enough at stake. During the 1650s, that began to change. The Atlantic world had been getting more important. Charles I had built a substantial navy, and Oliver Cromwell used it to expand English power in Europe and the West Indies. The English had gone to war with the Dutch at sea in 1652 and thrashed them. That focused attention in North America. As we've seen, the United Colonies of New England had declared war on New Netherland in 1653, and ultimately Oliver Cromwell had backed them. But the mother countries had made peace before New England's troops set out for New Amsterdam. In the course of the 1650s, Cromwell conquered Ireland and Jamaica and saw them as opportunities for settlement. Finally, between 1640 and 1660, the English population of New England had risen from 12, maybe 15,000 mostly religious refugees to more than 33,000 settlers from all walks of life. Not only was this population now significant enough that Cromwell wanted some of them to move to Ireland and Jamaica, but the trade it enabled, and especially the ships New Englanders built from the area's limitless trees, became legitimately important to English economic fortunes. By the 1640s, there were shipyards all along the New England coast, and during the 1600s, more than 1,000 English ships launched in those waters. Trade in goods was now so important that Parliament passed two navigation acts during this period, the first in 1651 and the second in 1660, both designed to control New England trading for the mother country's benefit. New England was now too lucrative to ignore. With the restoration of the monarchy, Charles II focused on rebuilding the English economy after nearly two decades of war. After all, unlike his predecessors, Charles II knew that he could not take his crown entirely for granted. At some level, it had to be earned, and that meant delivering on peace and prosperity. He cared about New England in part because New England was now much more important. That could mean many things, including imposing a royal governor, a fear of the Puritan settlers, or waging war to eliminate the threat of New Netherland to the west, an ambition of the Puritan settlers. At the same time, Charles and his Privy Council were well aware that New England was a hotbed of anti-royalist Puritanism, probably the most important concentration of #resist English subjects anywhere. Both the anti-royalist part and the Puritan part were nettlesome, and in theory unacceptable, but Charles and his advisors did not want to kill a goose that laid golden eggs. They wanted and indeed insisted that New England swear fealty to the new king, but they would do so with a light touch. There would not be, for a while anyway, a royal governor for New England. Nor would there be any heavy-handed insistence that the new English Puritans conform their services to the requirements of the Church of England. As with his close-to-universal amnesty at home, Charles didn't want conflict with New England. It was not, however, entirely clear to the people of New England that Charles would have that light touch in asserting royal authority. By design, the signals coming from London were mixed. Charles wanted New England to play ball without having to coerce the colonists. To do this, Charles had to keep his own hawks in line and hope that the hardcore separatists in New England, men like John Davenport, would not provoke hardcore royalists into pushing for a self-defeating crackdown. People like John Endicott, the governor of the Bay Colony all during this period, would debate the wisdom of signaling cooperation with, or resistance to, the newly restored monarchy. And so it was in this context that the authorities in the Bay began to wonder whether it was a good idea to protect regicides on whose heads Charles had set a considerable bounty. By the 1660s, there were a lot of ships sailing between England and New England. Each would learn of news in the other place 2 to 4 months after the fact of it. Just as the magistrates of the Bay heard of the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion on November 30, 1660, they knew that the news of Wally and Gough in the Boston area would reach England at around the same time. There were royalists in Boston who would make sure of it. During this time, Wally and Gough had been staying in Cambridge with Daniel Gookin, who had crossed with them on the Prudent Mary. This was no secret. Now even the good Puritans of Boston began to worry that harboring Wally and Gough was a bad idea because it might provoke Charles. On February 22, 1661, Governor Endicott summoned the Court of Assistance to discuss the problem. Daniel Gookin was among them, and therefore well aware of the debate. Would the benefits of arresting Wally and Gough justify the dishonor of turning over good Puritan patriots? Would knuckling under to the king's proclamation undermine the Bay Colony's long-cherished independence? Which was the better means for preserving that independence? In the end, the magistrates would not authorize an arrest just yet, but Daniel Gookin saw the writing on the wall. By February 26, 1661, Wally and Gough had left Cambridge without being seen, heading west for John Davenport's New England, 150 miles away through the snowy woods of a New England winter. Their route would have taken them west along the Bay Trail to Springfield, then south to Hartford, the capital of Connecticut Colony. John Winthrop Jr. was governor, and he welcomed the fleeing regicides warmly, if privately. Winthrop assigned a guide to Wally and Gough to help them along the less traveled path from Hartford to New Haven. New Haven was the right place to go, and Matthew Jenkinson enumerates the reasons. Quote, first, New Haven was the Puritan colony furthest from Boston, one of the first places to be searched should the restoration authorities cross the Atlantic. Second, New Haven had proved to be the colony most resistant to the restoration of Charles II. News of the king's return to England had arrived there on July 27, 1660, and its open rejection of a Stuart monarchy was considered a real possibility. Third, because of its open hostility, and perhaps because it was operating independently of an English proprietor, there was no individual ruling the colony answerable only to the king, New Haven harbored little hope of Charles II issuing them a charter guaranteeing legal recognition and protection. It was therefore barely worth cooperating with Charles against Wally and Gough. Fourth, one of the leading figures in New Haven was William Jones, son-in-law of New Haven's first governor, Theophilus Eaton, with whom the regicides had crossed the Atlantic and become friendly on the Prudent Mary. Interjection. Jenkinson does not say, but it seems reasonable to speculate that Davenport had heard of the regicides so soon after their arrival in New England because William Jones had gone on to New Haven quickly after coming ashore in Boston. Back to Jenkinson. Fifth, New Haven was the home of John Davenport, a preacher who delivered a sermon encouraging his congregation to, quote, hide the outcasts. Davenport was a friend and correspondent of Wally's brother-in-law, William Hook, who had spent time in New Haven during the 1640s. Back to me. Wally and Gough reached New Haven on March 7, 1661, and moved in with John Davenport. The next day, the magistrates of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, acting 2 weeks after their first meeting, issued an arrest warrant for Wally and Gough. John Endicott must have known that Wally and Gough were no longer in his jurisdiction, even if he would not yet know that they had reached New Haven. Endicott had played the game well. The delay had let the regicides escape in accordance with the wishes of most of the population, and the issuance of the warrant would make it appear that Massachusetts was supporting the crown. This would fool nobody when news of the delay would finally reach London, but it would make it more difficult for the prosecutors of the Restoration to overcome the factions who didn't want a royal trade relations with Puritan New England. After all, Massachusetts had issued the warrant. Meanwhile, on March 5th, 2 days before Wally and Gough reached New Haven and 3 days before the Bay issued its warrant, the Crown addressed a second proclamation to Massachusetts. It contained a technical drafting error that would give the New Englanders yet another reason to dilly-dally. It began, quote, to our trusty and well-beloved, the present governor or other magistrate or magistrates of our plantation of New England. There was, obviously, no governor of New England. No such person existed, but the colonists were paranoid that the restored monarchy was going to impose one. This error in salutation, per Charles Rex, did nothing to quell their anxiety. Back to the proclamation, mostly because it's funny king speak. Quote, trusty and well-beloved, we greet you well. We being given to understand that the Colonel Wally and Colonel Gough, who stand here convicted of the execrable murder of our royal father of glorious memory, are lately arrived in New England, where they hope to shroud themselves securely from our laws. Our will and pleasure is, and we do hereby expressly require and command you forthwith, upon the receipt of these our letters, to cause both the said persons to be apprehended, and with the first opportunity sent over hither under a strict care, to receive according to their demerits. We are confident of your readiness and diligence to perform your duty, and so bid you farewell, given at our court at Whitehall the 5th of March, 1661, by His Majesty's command, Edward Nicholas. Back to me. Of course, it would take a while for the second order to reach New England. In the meantime, the judges, or regicides, we do not take sides here, stayed with Davenport quietly through the end of April. Robert Morris, in his carefully researched historical novel Act of Oblivion, believes they stayed in the attic of Davenport's rather large house. Recall that it had 13 fireplaces. They are known to have left only once, in late March, when they traveled west to Milford, making sure to be seen. They may have let it be known they were headed to New Amsterdam. Morris, backed by Edward Atwater in his History of New Haven Colony, believes it was an intentional ruse, and that they doubled back through the woods and returned to Casa Davenport under cover of darkness. Now only Davenport and his small household would know for sure they were still in New Haven. Rumors that they had returned, however, spread through town. The Davenport household had doubled its regular order of food from the local grocer, who became suspicious. He was, apparently, not very discreet. On April 28, word of the Massachusetts arrest warrant from March 8 finally reached New Haven. Since so many locals suspected that Wally and Goff were hidden away in Davenport's house, on April 30th, they moved to the house of their friend William Jones. Also on April 28, sorry about all the dates here, but they matter a little, John Endicott received the Royal Order of March 5th, and having made a fairly speedy crossing. After some debate over its intended addressee, no doubt calculated to allow news of it to spread through the colony, Endicott signed it on May 6, 1661, and on May 7th engaged two royalists then in Boston to hunt for Wally and Goff. They were Thomas Kelland, a merchant, and Thomas Kirk, a shipmaster. Both were enthusiastic to recover the still offered bounty, but neither were savvy or competent in actual bounty hunting. Endicott suggested that Kelland and Kirk try New Amsterdam, either because he was misleading them or believed the rumors he had heard about the Milford ruse. The bounty hunters left Boston that very night and reached Hartford 3 days later. There they interviewed John Winthrop Jr., who told them that they had headed toward New Haven from Hartford. Whether Winthrop also told them that he had supplied them with a guide is not clear. Kelland and Kirk then went to Guilford, where resided William Leet, now the chief magistrate of New Haven Colony. Let's go to Atwater's fairly amusing account. Quote, Leet received them in the presence of several other persons. Looking after their papers, he began to read them audibly, whereupon we told him it was convenient to be more private in such concernments as that was. In other words, Leet read their orders aloud in front of others, so that word would spread quickly through the colony. Sneaky Leet. Back to Atwater. Retiring with them to another room, and thus giving opportunity for the rest of the company to disperse, Leet assured them that he had not seen the colonels for 9 weeks, that is, since the time when they passed through Guilford on the way from Hartford to New Haven. The pursuivants, love that old word, replied that they had information that the persons they were in pursuit of had been in New Haven since then and desired him to furnish them with horses for their further journey. The horses were, quote, prepared with some delays. Coming out from the governor's house, they were told on their way to the inn by one Dennis Scranton that the colonels were secreted at Mr. Davenport's, and that without all question, Leet knew as much. Other persons reported that they had very lately been seen between the houses of Mr. Davenport and Mr. Jones. Back to me. Kelland and Kirk returned to Leet and demanded the power within New Haven Colony, remember their commission was from Massachusetts Bay, to search and apprehend. Leet said that he could do nothing without consulting with the rest of the magistrates, and alas, it was now almost the Sabbath. It would be Monday before any such authorization might be forthcoming. On Monday, the bounty hunters and Leet went to New Haven for a meeting of the magistrates. The magistrates in New Haven debated the matter for 5 or 6 hours, Kelland and Kirk no doubt losing their minds with impatience and frustration and rage, and finally concluded that no decision could be made without convening a general court of all the freemen in the colony. Also, that could not happen until Friday, May 17th. Kelland and Kirk decided they couldn't suffer through even more delay, so they went to New Amsterdam, where they still hoped to find Wally and Goff. Failing that, they returned by sea to Boston, arriving on May 30th. There they delivered their report to John Endicott. The magistrates of the bay rewarded them for their service, granting each of Kelland and Kirk estates of 250 acres outside of town. There they retired, having suddenly lost all interest in bounty hunting. While Kelland and Kirk were in New Amsterdam, the general court at New Haven, knowing damn well that Wally and Goff were hiding nearby, issued an entirely disingenuous and derriere covering order for their arrest. To those who say the New Haven Puritans don't have a sense of humor, I say bollocks. Meanwhile, Wally and Gough made good use of New Haven's procedural delays on their behalf. On May 11th, they moved from Jones's house to an abandoned mill a couple of miles away in the woods, and then on May 13th to a location known as Hatchet Harbor. On May 15th, still 2 days before New Haven would issue its farcical warrant, they moved to the property of Richard Sperry, then a few miles out of town. On a ridge above his farm, there was a rock formation that afforded some shelter from the weather. They would live in that cave with at least one break until late August, Sperry's son bringing them food in a basket that they would hoist up the ridge on a rope. It is known to this day as Judge's Cave, complete with historical marker. You can see what it looks like from photos available on Google Maps. The failure of the New Englanders to nab the regicides was not lost on royalists, both in the colonies and London. Nor had the Crown failed to notice that the colonies had not sworn allegiance to His Majesty. No doubt this was difficult for the colonies to do, both as a matter of principle and because they were, at some level, democracies. The magistrates had voters to whom they would have to answer. Nevertheless, a year had passed since the Restoration, and the movers and shakers in London were growing impatient. While they were pretending diligence in their search for Wally and Gough, Connecticut proclaimed Charles II as king in March 1661, New Haven in June, and Massachusetts Bay in August. Even so, news got back to Charles' government that there was much opposition in Massachusetts, at least to the proclamation recognizing Charles. In the summer of 1661, Wally and Gough almost gave themselves up and made an appearance in New Haven. Perhaps they were just tired of being on the run, or maybe they wanted to relieve the pressure on Davenport and others who protected them. Regardless, in the 2 days they were in town, Governor Leet dithered again. Something changed their mind and they went back to Judge's Cave. On August 19th, with cooler weather coming, the two fugitives traveled to Milford and took up clandestine residence at the house of a Michael Tompkins, where they would live for more than 2 years. The question is, how clandestine were they? Perhaps not very. According to Jenkinson, John Davenport visited them regularly, and they probably shared private prayer meetings with the flower and chivalry of Milford, including William Leet. It's more likely that Milford was such a small place that even those who disapproved of Wally and Gough wouldn't want to alienate their neighbors by ratting them out. During the 2 years that Wally and Gough were in Milford, a lot changed. The Restoration authorities in London were still officially seeking their arrest, but were losing interest. Whatever the grumpiness toward the colonies over the regicides, if you listen to the episodes on New Haven, you know that John Winthrop Jr. was able to obtain a charter for Connecticut Colony on April 23, 1662. New Haven Colony was increasingly on the outs, as it were, and its sheltering of the regicides became a point of leverage for Connecticut in the protracted negotiations over the annexation of New Haven. In the spring of 1664, London made one last attempt to track down Wally and Gough, who were still in Milford. It was decidedly half-hearted, quoting Jenkinson. On April 25th, instructions were given to four royal commissioners to travel to the New England colonies in New Amsterdam. This may sound like a major attempt to capture the regicides, but it was not. First, the wording of the commission sent from London was, with regard to the regicides, intriguingly subtle. Second, the commission had many other responsibilities. The regicides were a minor concern. Third, like Kellen and Kirk, the quality of the personnel put behind any such search was questionable. Back to me. The commissioners arrived in July 1664 in a great show of imperial power, with four warships and 400 soldiers. The main target of the fleet was New Netherland, which would fall bloodlessly within a month. The commissioners were supposed to do a bunch of things, including to determine the extent to which English trade laws were being enforced, to ascertain whether the king might be able to take over the colonial militias and appoint a royal governor, to assess the colonial defenses, economy, politics, and religious condition, and to express the king's displeasure at the refusal of the Puritans and the colonies to use the Church of England's Book of Common Prayer. Regarding the regicides, the mandate was virtually an afterthought to make due inquiry into their whereabouts. As Jenkinson suggests, the commissioners were lazy second-raters. The magistrates of the bay ran rings around them, and over the next year or so baited the commissioners into one blockheaded move after another. Finally, they demanded to meet with the freemen of the colony directly. The magistrates just said no. Of course, it would have been difficult for Whalley and Gough or their abettors in Milford to assess the incompetence of the royal commissioners. When they got wind that the hunt was back on, the fugitives went back to Judge's Cave for the summer, while plans could be made for another place of refuge. On October 13, 1664, they made their way to the frontier town of Hadley, Massachusetts, which sits about 17 miles north of Springfield, which you guys know all about. John Davenport probably arranged it, insofar as he'd been mentor to Hadley's minister. From this point on, we know very little about the lives of Whalley and Gough. We know that the third regicide in North America, John Dixwell, would visit Whalley and Gough on February 10, 1665. We do not know how Dixwell had learned of their whereabouts, but he was a recent arrival to New England and still had found them fairly quickly. After the Restoration, Dixwell had gone to Germany and lived there for almost 5 years under an assumed name. Eventually, though, the Restoration's agents made things too hot on the continent. The areas of the regicides who'd fled there were caught and killed. Indeed, for a while, rumors had circulated that Whalley and Gough had been killed in Switzerland. Having now come to New England, Dixwell would have wanted to learn from Whalley and Gough how they'd gotten along and perhaps just compare their experiences of life on the run. It is unlikely he would have wanted to stay with them. Whalley and Gough were family, of higher social rank, and had long shared deprivation and close quarters. Dixwell would have been a third wheel. According to Jenkinson, who devotes a short appendix to Dixwell, quote, Whalley and Gough may have suggested that Dixwell travel to New Haven, where they had themselves received kind hospitality. Whatever his purpose or motivation, Dixwell did travel to New Haven and stayed there for over 2 decades under the pseudonym James Davids. He boarded initially with an elderly couple, Benjamin and Joanna Ling. Benjamin died on April 27, 1673, at which point Dixwell married Joanna, in a marriage perhaps based on property rights rather than romantic love. Joanna would have wanted to ensure that Dixwell had somewhere to live in the event of her death. As it happened, Joanna died a month after her second marriage, but Dixwell continued to live in relative comfort. His health and comfortable being was reported on November 1676, though he did suffer from swollen feet, the remedy for which, apparently, was to wash them in brandy. Dixwell was also provided with clothing, shoes, and books. On October 23, 1677, at the age of about 70, Dixwell married Bathsheba Howe, a woman less than half his age. Go Dixwell. Back to me. John Dixwell would die, still under his assumed name, on March 18, 1689, well into his 80s. Point is, he earned that street in New Haven. We only hear of Whalley and Gough a couple more times. Whalley, who was some years older than his son-in-law, would die in late 1674. Gough would emerge from hiding one more time and become forever known as the Angel of Hadley. In June 1675, King Philip's War broke out between the New England colonies and a coalition of tribes led by Metacom of the Wampanoag, who is known to the colonists as King Philip. Some historians say it was the bloodiest war in American history as a proportion of the European population, with more than 2,000 English dead. But on my math, that thinking sells both Opechancanough and Tascaloosa short. No matter, we'll get to that later. For our purposes now, the key point is that fighting broke out in all the frontier outposts in New England, including Hadley. In the summer of 1676, on a Sabbath day, all hell broke out in Hadley. Here's how Thomas Hutchinson described it in his History of Massachusetts decades later. Quote, "The town of Hadley was alarmed by the Indians in time of public worship, and the people were in the utmost confusion. Suddenly, a grave elderly person appeared in the midst of them. In his mien and dress, he differed from the rest of the people. He not only encouraged them to defend themselves, but put himself at their head, rallied, instructed, and led them on to counter the enemy, who by this means were repulsed. As suddenly, the deliverer of Hadley disappeared. The people were left in consternation, utterly unable to account for this strange phenomenon." Back to me, William Goff, the old veteran of Oliver's New Model Army, had emerged from the house of his long refuge to lead the people of Hadley to victory. And then he was gone. He would live secretly in the basement in Hadley for 3 more months and then slip out under cover of darkness to Hartford. He would assume the alias T. Duffel and live there 3 more years under the protection of the Bull family. So ends the story of the regicides in America, but not the story of the story. How do we know that all of this happened? Largely through their correspondence and the echoes of Goff's diary. John Davenport, it seems, developed a means for smuggling letters to and from family in England, some of which survive. His diary would make it into the hands of Thomas Hutchinson, descendant of Anne, the royal governor of Massachusetts just before the Revolution, and author of the first comprehensive history of that colony. Sadly, the diary itself would be destroyed on August 26, 1765, when a mob in Boston, outraged at the Stamp Act, burned Hutchinson's house. Some abstracts of it, including Hutchinson's history, survived. We also know some of the story from the first History of the Regicides, written by Ezra Stiles. Stiles' book's an oral history built on interviews with descendants of people who had harbored the regicides, who recounted family stories. Hutchinson and Stiles told their stories very differently. Hutchinson, the consummate royalist, argued that in general, the colonists had cooperated with the crown in the pursuit of the regicides, an example of their loyalty to the king. Stiles, writing just after the Revolution, emphasized their obstruction and dilly-dallying as a reflection of their independence. Jenkinson, it must be said, subscribes, in this respect, to the theory of Stiles. Jenkinson's book is also interesting for its several chapters on the cultural significance of the regicides in our history, followed by their disappearance from the American consciousness until a very recent revival. If you want to read a great novel with a gripping telling of the Battle of Hadley and more about their personal lives, I highly recommend Robert Harris's recent novel, Act of Oblivion. You can buy it through the link in the show notes on the website. Thank you again for listening to the History of the Americans podcast. Your emails have been very encouraging. Please keep them coming. You can reach me with questions, corrections, eruptions of indignation, or pats on the back on the contact page of the website, thehistoryoftheamericans.com, or by email at thehistoryoftheamericans@gmail.com. And please do me the great favor of giving the podcast a 5-star rating on Apple and following me on X for cranky musings on mostly history-related matters. Until next time.